So the first half of the morning will be spent continuously, I won't break it, on the eighth commandment, which reads, "You shall not bear false witness against your neighbour." The first comment mightn't be that obvious to you, but once you see it, it'll be clear. In a society such as theirs, which depended greatly on the threat of capital punishment to maintain law and order, and don't forget the capital punishment was always Yahweh said, so this is from God, as they thought, Yahweh said, it's their way of expressing their insight into life from their perception of God. So when the prophets and others have a strong urge to see something wrong in their society, and it's always, of course, culturally conditioned, it's always historically conditioned and so on, Yahweh said is their way of saying this is from God. Ergo, we needed to hear Jesus say, it was said to you of old, but I say to you. Like, that has to be corrected more often than not, because their perceptions were necessarily imperfect. So there's a value there. So here, in their world, Yahweh was the judge and the one who kept order in the society, so anything they judged important for the society came from Yahweh. And it depended on capital punishment. Well, once you realise that, there's an obvious close connection between the eighth commandment and the fifth commandment. Thou shalt not kill. It is wrong to unjustly murder another person. It's also wrong to lie about others in court in such a way as to bring about their death. It's an indirect way of doing it. And the 8th, 9th and 10th commandment are, in their world, quite extraordinary, because they're actually not about action so much, what you do, but they're a first attempt to go internal and look at motivation, what you're really on about, you're not killing, you're lying about someone in court in order to get them killed. You're not committing adultery, you're lusting after someone else's wife. You know, you're not stealing, you're actually working out means of robbing other people's property by organising the law such that they can't afford it and they have to sell and you have to buy. And do you get it? It's a more subtle entry into morality. Well, this commandment, the eighth one, is quoted by Jesus and refined by him, because he says not only must you speak the truth when you're under oath, false witness, but you should speak the truth all the time. There's a quote there from St. Paul to the Romans, although everyone is a liar, cheer up, let God be proved true. Jesus once said, the truth, so we're talking about truth now, the truth will set you free. Paul reminds the Christians of Thessalonica of the same truth when he says, when he speaks of those who refuse to love the truth and so be saved. Salvation, that is to say, finding meaning and life, comes from God, says Paul to the Thessalonians, through sanctification, being made holy by the Spirit, and through belief in the truth. The truth to which Paul is referring, and in fact this is the way the word is used every single example in the John's Gospel of truth, is referring to the truth of who God really is. And how God has chosen to relate to us. I can't say anything more important about truth than that. In the scriptural sense, truth isn't just an abstract answer to an abstract question. You got it right, so you tick it. The truth is, who is God? What is God really like? And of course, God is love, is Jesus' answer in his actions and in his words. So this is the essence of the good news revealed by Jesus. And it's that truth that will set us free, and it's that truth, knowing who God is, which means getting rid of all the false gods that are in our heads and in religions generally, because all religions are full of false ideas of God, getting rid of that and actually focusing on Jesus and learning that God is actually love, that's the truth that Jesus, Paul, New Testament is constantly speaking of. Paul's hymn to love in Corinthians 13 includes the phrase, love rejoices in the truth. In the light of this, perhaps the best advice Paul ever gave, or it's the one that I really love most and would like to live, is when he says, do the truth in love. A little bit on a personal note, I've always been, this is not going to sound as good at the end as it sounds at the beginning, but I've always been someone who really wanted to know the truth. I've got that kind of mind, I guess, and many of you have. And Mum used to say I was an absolute pain as a kid. And most kids probably are too, but she'd ask me a question and I'd pursue it, and then I'd get the next question, then I'd get the next question, then I'd get the next question, because it wasn't so, you know, you can give kids answers and they seem satisfied even though you haven't said anything, and they run off and play. That's probably very healthy. Apparently I wasn't like that. I would just say, yeah. I remember one of the questions I asked her that she told me about later on was, about how babies are born. And she told me some beautiful story about Mary and the angel Gabriel and God, and it was all very spiritual and all a bit confusing. And it ended up that, you know, God sends the baby and that. And then I said, but what about in the bed, you see? And what about if you and Auntie Bertha were in bed and the baby was there? How would you know whose baby it was? So Mum had to go and restart. Anyhow. But where I'm heading in this little anecdote about my own life is that I thought I was interested in the truth, and I guess I am. But I discovered, to my own enlightenment, maybe is the word, many years ago now, but I discovered that I actually like something more than truth. And it got me quite tricked. I like being loved, and I like loving people. I guess that's pretty normal, isn't it? And I was accused of something falsely, not entirely falsely, but it was wrong. And I discovered that I'm the kind of person who's more likely to admit something that's not true in order to please someone or that they might like me. Do you know what I mean? To even things over. I don't tell a deliberate lie, but I'll take responsibility inappropriately to please, because everyone feeling happy is what I... I didn't like discovering that about myself, because I thought I was into the truth. And I guess I was, but not entirely. And so hopefully, I think I have, I've learnt that statement of Paul. I really love it, and it helped me then. Do the truth in love. In other words, you're given a choice. And the truth is whatever best you can do. You have to discover it. It's internal. But when I see something is the right thing to do and the truthful thing to do, do it, take the consequences, and then do it as lovingly as you can. But don't put love first. I'm talking to myself. Don't put love first, because if love comes first, it might trick me into fudging with the truth. Am I being making some sense? So this is a great statement, I think, and now I'm aware of it, and I'm trying to help others become aware of it. And often I find in relationships people, because you like to be happy with your spouse, or you like to be happy with her, so you'll fudge the truth to be loving. And I actually think, I'd love your opinion sometime too, but I actually think that's a very bad way to behave. That one must stand with one's own truth and the other person, and seek the truth, of course, and don't pretend you've got it entirely. Be constantly open to learn, humbly, but insofar as this is how it seems to me to be, I should state it and act on it and then do it as lovingly as I can and not shift. All right, I've said enough on that. So, love, he says, rejoices in the truth. In the light of this, yes, Paul says, do the truth in love. Sometimes we think, well, this is me, obviously, sometimes we think we're insisting on the truth, but we fail in love. You can't have truth without love. For the ultimate truth is that God is love. And that's not me so much, the other one is. But I think of that when I hear, oh, I don't want to pick on anybody, and I certainly won't mention any names, but when you get some, you often, for my case, a church authority who pounds the truth, but there's no love. Well, if in that case it's totally clear to me, it's not the truth. It might be the right answer to a wrong question, or it might be a point of view that's very important, you know what I mean? And it's thumped. But if the person is not listening to me or to you or to the world or to people's experience, and if they're not humble, and if there's not a love there between, then obviously the person who's saying, this is what you've got to do, hasn't the faintest idea. So I've learnt to totally ignore them. I mean, totally ignore them. No, I mean, you know, I think it's healthy, isn't it, to not to say they've got no insight, but I know it's not true what they're saying, because they're not listening or loving or connecting. And when someone does come along who listens, loves, connects and says, oh, what you're doing is wrong, I really think, you know, you should think more about it. This would be a better way to do. I find myself listening to them and following them usually, don't you? Because you feel there's been the person knows where you're coming from, and the advice often is very sensible and very wise. But the rest of it, we do best to avoid it, to stand your ground and duck. And, you know, when there's a hurricane, the big trees snap and the blades of grass go, and when the hurricane ends up they go, haven't been hurt by it, they just bend and then come back again. So sometimes you've got to be like a blade of grass and just, or say yes kindly and then go away and keep going. Another distraction. My mother was like that, apparently, she told me, because her mother used to say to her, talk to her, so I've heard, and then she'd say to her mother, I beg your pardon, something, 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 and then she'd say, and the mother would say, oh, well, and she'd say, but you don't really think I'm right, do you? No, as a matter of fact, I don't, darling. She kind of stood her ground, didn't you? Sometimes we think we're insisting on the truth, but we're failing in love. You can't have truth without love, because the truth is that God is love. That is the truth. God is love. Sometimes, and this gets back to, we think we're being loving, but we're bending the truth to feel good, to let others feel good, to stop all the angst. Love isn't real when it's not truthful. The truth must always be the foundation, the reality. It must be real. We're to do what is true, to do it with all the love we can muster. The faith community can help us in this, for as St. Paul said to Timothy, the church of the living God is the column and pedestal of the truth. Here's a bit of English, Greek, and various other things, just because I think words are very fascinating things, and I'm sure you do too. There's the word truth, and it's etymologically related to the word troth. I plight my troth. Incidentally, it's also related to the word betroth. To be betrothed is to be in a truthful commitment to someone. So trust and truth and troth are related. Someone I can rely on. Truth is something you can put your trust in, plight your troth to. And here's the Greek, which is really lovely. That's the Greek New Testament word. The Greek is aletheia. And you might know, I only know it from Keats's poem, you know, Lethe woods I sank, however it goes, you know. Lethe is that river in the underworld, because they had this notion, some of them had, that actually we've all existed before. Some people take that quite seriously, and good luck to them, and maybe we were. I haven't the foggiest idea, but I doubt it. So, but the reason why you don't remember your prior existence is that when you died, last time you died, you went across this river, and it was all kind of, the hard drive got scrambled, and then you start again as a baby. But every now and then you have these little feelings that link back to when you were a witch somewhere in northern England, or when you were actually Pope Alexander VI having a great time on the throne. Whatever. So, letheia, see forgot, letheia, forgetfulness. And Greek, in Greek, the A at the front is negating, like moral and amoral, you know, the A's. So, aletheia means not forgotten, not forgotten. So the truth is, if I were speaking the truth to you, then what's happening is the reality isn't hidden behind a mask or a kind of method of speaking that might please you or win votes or deceive you enough to get you to buy or to vote for me. But the truth is nowhere there, like it's unmasked. You're getting the mask. You're seeing something. And the truth is actually forgotten because it's hidden behind ecclesiastical speech or litigation speech or political speech or whatever it might be. So truth happens when what is what is seen to be. What you see is what you get. What is said has come from the heart and is the genuine. And I suppose because we're all a bit unsure of ourselves, the mask sometimes works, but it actually does surprise me because I actually suspect that just about everybody I know, really, if someone, say a politician, actually says what he thinks and says it, he or she, and says it clearly, if I hear Mandela speak, why am I so impressed? I think it's because you feel what he said about Iraq is right. He's not staying with this opinion or that opinion or pleasing someone. It's just, and I don't say he does it all the time. I don't know him well enough. Whereas when people come up with all the rubbish stuff, we all kind of know, don't we? You kind of half know that you're being hoodwinked, but then you don't quite know. It's too complex. So anyhow. So truth, that's all I want to say. The truth is that what is what is seen, what is heard, and it's a beautiful thing. And we've got to be committed to it, and we haven't never got it entirely, but we're journeying more and more to discover the truth. To say that a judgment is true is to claim that it is in accordance with the way things really are, not just the way we would like things to be. The ultimate reality is God. Everything is an expression of God. Truth is always an aspect of God. And that's the tragedy of a secularist, atheist kind of culture, that if I don't open myself to the mystery of the divine, I will never discover the truth. I'm missing a whole dimension. I can't define it, of course, or lock it in, but to know that everything is sacred, to know that everything is an expression of the mystery of God, and we keep redefining our image of God so that it becomes more and more pure through experience, and listen to Jesus who shows us that God is love, all of that, it opens us up to the truth at a deeper level. Whereas if we ignore all that, we get truths, we get insights, but we don't actually ever attain the truth. The beloved disciple came to recognize Jesus as the human expression of the real God. That is to say, as he says in John chapter 1, verse 16, I think, he is full of the gift of truth. As he says in the prologue, the Word became flesh and lived among us, and we have seen his glory, the glory as of a Father's only Son, full of the gift of truth. The gift Jesus gave was to show us what God is really like. Show in human form, of course. How else could he do it? Who God really is. John portrays Jesus as declaring, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And promising, when the Spirit of truth comes, he will guide you into all the truth. So, these are questions for your and my reflection. Do I always seek the truth? Is that what I really want? Even when it's embarrassing. My brother Jim, who died last year while I was in Rome, was a very good example of this to me, because I'm going back many years when I first noticed it. He would have a very strong opinion on something, and I'm quite capable of it. It comes through the family, you know, a very strong opinion on something, and I'd be discussing something with him, and I'd make a point, he'd say, oh, I never thought of that, and he'd change his mind. No, I do that too, and I guess we all do it, but not everyone does it all the time. Some people defend their position because it's theirs, not because it's true. So to be strongly committed to a point of view with good reasons, but to be instantly ready to hear something that you didn't know and to recognize it and to grab hold of it, letting go the immense energy that's gone into the last 5 minutes of conversation that you've had, it's pretty good, isn't it? And I think that's wonderful, really. And I'd like to be like it, and I'd like you all to be like it. Because when the truth is embarrassing, are we ready to admit it? What about when it means that I have to admit that I've been wrong? What about when the truth means financial loss? Or loss of reputation? This has been part of the problem in the church, really, when things were badly done, and then people, in the name of defending the church, I, as a priest, say, who've got a responsibility, obviously, to the community of the church, I defend the church rather than look for the truth, you know what I mean? It never works, but that's a tendency that's, I think, almost inevitable, really. And you do it to your family, too, and no one likes, well. Am I willing to change my mind when evidence shows that I'm wrong? And a really wonderful question to ask ourselves, do I want the truth, whatever the cost? It's vitally important to grow to be able to say yes to that last question. Whatever the cost, that's what I want. And that's what this eighth commandment is about. Let's listen to John Henry Newman, because he's great. Wonderful English writer. You know who he is, I presume. Died 1891, I think, or close to then anyhow, the end of the 1800s. In relation to religion, John Henry Newman had to make huge sacrifices to be at home with the truth. He was the Anglican chaplain of Oxford University and a brilliant person, totally brilliant person. And Catholicism in England at the time was largely Irish, was foreign. I mean, there were wonderful English families that had kept the faith forever, but they were quite a small minority. Most of English Catholics were Liverpool and, you know, over from Ireland working, and the poor and so on. So he set out to show, as you probably know, that Anglicanism was the via media, the reasonable middle ground between Catholicism, which was about, I'm not saying what he said, but, you know, and Catholicism was largely Mediterranean. So it was about statues and rosary beads and processions and Mary and a whole lot of other things, and pretty flagrant sex too, I have to tell you, in the warm climates, because you might as well, if you're in a warm climate, freezing to death in the north, they're not into that, they're into reading and writing philosophy and producing music. I mean, there's a lot of truth in what I've... Anyhow, it's got a lot to do with the weather. So... It was the halfway between Catholicism, which I've now exaggeratedly, and the extreme Protestantism, which is egocentric and all the rest of the stuff, and tiny and not open to the sacrament and not open to anything, just locked into Bible and, you know, well, okay. So he thought Anglicanism was the thing. So he set out to prove it, because he was quite brilliant, and he started to write books about it and look into the early fathers and go into the... And I don't want to go any longer on this, but poor John Henry Newman, the more he went into it, for him, the more he couldn't sustain his point of view. He came to see that, in fact, Catholicism, and it's not cultural, was really where he had to be. So he decided to become Catholic. Well, that meant he had to lose his job, he had to lose his everything, and he ended up, they appointed him, God bless him, to Ireland to start a university in Dublin. For my great-grandparents, hobbing around horse thieves in Roscommon. So he had a very difficult life. Like the friends he left and the friends he made. Anyhow, he did it. But he wrote this thing called An Essay on the Development of Christian Doctrine, and I'm about to read you from it. Some claim, and he took that journey because he wanted the truth more than anything. Some claim that truth and falsehood in religion are but a matter of opinion. That one doctrine is as good as another. That the governor of the world doesn't intend that we should gain the truth. That there is no truth. That we're not more acceptable to God by believing this than by believing that. That no one is answerable for his opinions. That it's enough if we sincerely hold what we profess, that we may take up and lay down opinions at pleasure, that we may safely trust to ourselves in matters of faith, and we don't need any other guide. I ask you to pause for a minute. That is so common today, isn't it? That is almost the normal opinion. And when I put it up there, I bet you all have to ask yourself, doesn't look too bad to me. Like, you know what I mean? It's a temptation to us all, because that's the world we're in now. Well, imagine it was 100 and whatever years ago when he was writing, and it was like, it was beginning to be like that then. And he's going to oppose it, because he must. So, he continues. Liberalism, there is truth. There is, he claims, there is a truth. There is one truth. Religious error is of itself of an immoral nature. He's not saying that you're sinful for having a wrong opinion in this. You do your best from where you start. But the fact that you think wrongly about religious matters is of an immoral nature. It has bad effects on education, children, etc. Those who maintain it, unless they do so involuntarily, are guilty in maintaining it. Religious error is to be dreaded. The search for truth is not the gratification of curiosity. The mind is below truth, not above it, and is bound not to descant upon it, but to venerate it. Truth and falsehood are set before us for the trial of our hearts. That's very strong. And if you said it today, I think people wouldn't like hearing it. On the whole, I think it's true, what he's saying. It's just very clear, and that makes it a bit edgy. But he's talking from his own painful experience. And he's saying, no, we must want the truth. I remember, and you'd have many memories of this, I suppose, because I don't get so much of this now, being in a presbytery, but when I was seminary, when I was the chaplain at the university, I lived in a home with other people, and there's this knock on the door, and a chap lands at the, you know, with two of them, they came two by two, and he didn't know who I was, and it didn't matter. And he started to come up with his absolute drivel, absolute religious drivel. And I said to him, who wrote that? So he went to the back of his Bible. Poor man, I'm not blaming him, but he was elderly. He might have been 50, and he had a young man with him about 20-something. And they were knocking on doors and saving everybody from the Catholic Church, including... So when he said, he looked at the back and said, oh, Moses. And I said, for God's sake, the stuff was written in the 3rd century BC, and you know by the look of the words. I said, I've got a library inside, would you like to read it? What I meant was, here he was, and I'd be just as at fault if I did it myself, here he was knocking on doors without going to the process of discovering was what he's saying true, you know? He just wasn't doing the work. When I offered him books to read, he wouldn't read them. So he belonged, in other words, to a sect, I suppose you'd say, that had their own little world within which they think and which controls their thinking, and he's doing his best. But I was thinking of the young man walking around with him. They're obviously two good people because they're willing to do all this, you know, for what they think. But it's not good, is it, to just do things without doing the work first and discovering. If you were a dentist and did it, you'd be out of a job tomorrow, I hope. If you were a doctor and did it, you'd be scrapped. If you were a lawyer and did it, if you were anybody and did it. But in the area of religion, apparently you can say what you like and get away with it and get on with it and not try and discover it. So that's Newman. And now, in case you think he might have changed his mind, in 1879 he was made a cardinal, and this was part of his speech. Liberalism in religion is the doctrine that there is no positive truth in religion, but that one creed is as good as another. And this is the teaching which is gaining substance and force daily. And if I hear it once a day, I don't know how often you hear it, oh, we're all going the same way. When other people say that to me, I said, well, I don't know, which way are you going? Tell me about it, then we can work it out. Because maybe we're not going in the same way. But it is inconsistent with the recognition of any religion as true. It teaches that all are to be tolerated, for all are matters of opinion. Revealed religion is not a truth, it's a sentiment and a taste. Not an objective fact, not miraculous. It's the right of each individual to make it say just what strikes his fancy. Now there's a man approaching 90 who is thoroughly convinced of the importance of truth. If Jesus tells us that God is love, we have to ask a simple question: is that true or false? If it's true, it has immense implications for the world, for Islam, for Judaism, for American fundamentalism, for the Vatican, for, you know what I mean? It's just, it has immense implications everywhere. If it's false, if God isn't love, do you get me? That has immense implications for the world and for everything we're doing. And most of us are just wasting our life away with this fancy idea of a fairy queen mother God who doesn't exist. So we better do something about searching this out to see, is it true? Now, how do you find whether it's true? It's a big question and it's a big journey. But it does mean listening, learning, discovering, searching, all of that, which we're all bound to do and can't just leave as an optional extra at the side. And it doesn't really matter what we think about God. You know, as well as I do, it matters enormously the way. And once people can see, for example, that God is actually love, what an immense difference it makes to everything about their life. Everything about their life. Because it helps them believe that Jesus was showing them something beautiful. And by their life, you then learn that it's true, because the growth that happens in people's lives, the blossoming, the bird flies rather than caged, surely you're onto something that's working and real, because it's actually bearing fruit. A few more little things about truth, and then I'll give you a break. Truth, however, must not be imposed. Now, the church had to learn this. The culture had to learn it. Here's Vatican II, Declaration on Religious Freedom, one of the great documents of the modern world here. And it was a change of focus for the church. Truth can impose itself on the human mind only in virtue of its own truth, which wins over the mind with both gentleness and power. That's beautiful, isn't it? Very important. You can't impose truth. And there were many centuries when, because people like Newman knew what they were saying, the truth is so important, they thought it was better to impose it for the safety of people so they'd be in the right place than to allow people to search and discover and make mistakes and learn and then welcome the truth. A second consideration: we have to seek the truth. Here's the same document. We are impelled by our nature to seek the truth, to adhere to it once discovered, and to direct our whole lives in accordance with its demands. Here's a couple of saints. Angela Merici, the foundress of the Ursulines, has this to say. This is in the prologue to the Ursuline Rule. Happy are those whom God fills with the light of truth and gives a keen longing for their heavenly home, and who then try to keep alive within them the voice of truth and this longing. Therese of Lisieux, great girl for this. If I'm not loved, that's just too bad, she said. I tell the whole truth, and if anyone doesn't want to know the truth, let her not come looking for me. Well, that's not bad. I mean, it's good that anyone could say something like that and they could be the biggest, you know. But this is a saint talking. I like it, don't you? Oh my God, she says, I really want to listen to you. I beg you to answer me when I say humbly, what is truth? Make me see things as they really are. Let nothing cause me to be deceived. And this is her last words from her deathbed, picked up by the community around her and written down. It'd be lovely to be able to say this, wouldn't it, as you're dying? It seems to me that I never sought anything but the truth. And then a few other words which I've left out. I'm not sorry for handing myself over to love. Oh, I love him. My God, I love you. And they tell us that when Therese said that, she had dying of tuberculosis, she sat up in bed for the length of a credo with a beautiful smile on her face and then just sank back onto the pillow and died. Extraordinary death of an extraordinary woman. And here's Yeats, great poet. I like this. He was 45 when he wrote this, and his best poetry was written after this. He said, though leaves are many, the root is one. Through all the lying days of my youth, I swayed my leaves and branches in the sun. Now I may wither into the truth. God. It's powerful, isn't it? The poets have got this capacity to find words for what we all know is right. So all his energy went back into the bowl. And of course the leaves, and like winter, lost their leaves, but now he's holding to something. Now, two more pages, and here's a list of all the sins against the eighth commandment. So I want you all to listen very carefully. Why I know so much about it, I don't know. Probably because I've read about it. No, you ready? Giving false witness, obviously, under oath. I was a young seminarian, 19 or something. One of my brothers, there were two of us, my other brother was in the seminary with me towards the end, and one of my brothers came down from Sydney somewhere, and we went out for a car ride on our holiday time, which we never did, but I did this time, and we were going up a street like this, and a car came careering, as my brother said, in, like a bat out of hell, round the corner, passed us, and when we looked in the rear vision, we saw it's not going to make that corner. And sure, it didn't. We could see the so we went back. It tipped over, going at a hell of So tipped over. We were kind of climbing around and it, and we went over and we got blankets for it. The whole day was spoiled, you could say. Got blankets for them and didn't. I don't know what how we made sure someone came. Got them all fixed up. Then they weren't apparently insured or something. Then we got sued. My brother got sued for dangerous driving or something. So we had to go to court. It was the only time I've ever been to court as a witness. And our stories were hopeless because we didn't get together and decide what we're going to say. We just said what we saw it. So I had it about 20 yards off the end of the thing, and someone else had it, my other brother had it about, I thought it was more like 30, and someone was saying, oh, no, it was about 50, really. Yeah. We were all kind of giving our witness and most unbelievable stuff, but true, you know what I mean? We're just saying as we saw it. Constant factor in it all was the truth of what we were doing. We were just going on this. So yeah, but they got up. I couldn't believe it. They got up and started. They all had the same story. There was about five or six in the car, and none of it was true. And I can remember sitting there in my innocence, because I didn't know, thinking, but they've just taken it. You know, they've just taken an oath. What? And they're absolutely telling a lie. Organized lie. Well, thank God the magistrate probably saw us stupid people who didn't know what we were talking about and recognised we were fair dinkum, and, you know, so we won the thing. But anyway. So that's bad, obviously. Rash judgment is bad. Judging without evidence. Detraction. Detraction is when you tell the truth about someone to someone who has no right to know it. There's a fair bit of that goes on. Calumny. I actually think calumny is not as bad as detraction. Calumny is when you tell a lie about someone to someone else. Where calumny is a bit weak is that the truth can sometimes be shown to be wrong, you know. But if you tell the truth about me to someone else, I've got no defence, have I? I can't say it's not true. I'm caught, obviously. Flattery. An awful thing, flattery. But be careful, because we do it to our grandchildren. We do it to our children. We want people to feel good. We say to someone who's got a voice like a frog, "Oh, darling, you've got such a lovely voice." And we encourage them, we do. And we say to someone who's playing the piano, "Oh, that was beautiful." And it was. Mind you, I know it's tricky, because I had an experience once myself. I was in a room like this, and there was a door, and there was a person playing the piano next door, playing, let's say it was Fur Elise or something, you know. And it was not very good. And you know, I thought, gee, I'd hate to live in a house with someone practicing the piano all day. It would drive you balmy. And it wasn't really a good sound. It was, you know, bearable, but not real good. And here's me making all my judgments. I opened the door. It was the first time I'd ever seen this. I'd opened the door. There was a blooming three-year-old sitting at the piano playing. Three or four, I can't be sure. There's a method, isn't there, of training little tiny... And isn't it... It was the same sound from here and from there. And I went from thinking, oh, God, wouldn't you think, you know, people would play at home or play the piano somewhere else. And then I went in and I thought, oh, isn't that marvellous? Because it was marvellous for a two, three-year, four-year-old to play. So everything's relative. But flattery is when we say untruths to please people. Adulation. Boasting. Lying. To speak, to lie is to speak or act against the truth in order to leave into error. This is number 2483 of the Catechism. Someone who has the right to know the truth. Look at every sentence in that. It's very important. Lying is when you speak or act against the truth to lead into error someone who has the right to know the truth. As a priest, of course, this is totally obvious. The seal of confession, for example. If someone were to ask me, "Oh, did my husband come to confession this morning?" Okay, what have I got to do? If I say, yes, I've told them something they have no right to know. If I say, well, I don't really, you know, I don't answer questions like that, which is probably what I would say, you just leave them blank. But often if you just hedge something, people know the truth, don't they? Often if you put something a bit vague, they say, ah. So I'd be quite willing to say no. No. Oh, Father tells us, off they go. I've told them a lie. Do you know what I mean? But I haven't told them a lie, because they've asked a question they have no right to know. And if you need to actually abruptly contradict it, do so, because that's not a lie. You're protecting someone else's rights against an inquisitive person. Mostly you can get by a general statement, but sometimes, at least this is an intuition I have, sometimes a vague put-off statement alerts them to the truth. So, but that's the Catechism there. Good. There's a duty to try to put right the harm that has been done, Catechism also says, and no one is bound to reveal the truth to someone who does not have the right to know it. There's a statement here in the Catechism on professional secrecy, number 2491. Professional secrets, for example, those of political office holders, soldiers, physicians and lawyers, or confidential information given under the seal of secrecy, must be kept, save in exceptional cases where keeping the secret is bound to cause very great harm to the one who confided it, to the one who received it, or to a third party, and where the very grave harm can be avoided only by divulging the truth. So all you whistleblowers, thank you very much. You're brave, courageous people. Even, that wasn't in the catechism, that was my remark. Even if not confided under the seal of secrecy, private information prejudicial to another is not to be divulged without a grave and proportionate reason. I think it's a pretty sensible statement and pretty vague and hard to pin down, but finally, the Catechism 2492 interferes by the media in the private lives of persons engaged in political or public activity is to be condemned to the extent that it infringes upon their privacy and their freedom. And another statement, nothing can justify recourse to disinformation for manipulating public opinion through the media. Okay, well, that's all I want to offer you on the Eighth Commandment. Take a break and a cup of coffee.